Our final stage of our learning of these halachos, and this is really the topic that turns the title on its head. Namely, we were studying the laws of Bishul Akum, if a non-Jew cooks for you. So this final topic, which as I said will probably be two or three installments once we're completed, is really, I've entitled it Bishul Yisrael. In other words, in what way, now obviously you'll tell me if a Jew cooks for the whole meal, so then of course that's not the topic. So the answer is, of course not. And that's obviously not what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about something a little bit more subtle and involved. But the possibility that is out there for us to, so to speak, avoid the problem by having a Jew participate. We saw over our 2-month-plus study that there was different reasons why the halacha might not apply if the food was either too, edible raw, if it wasn't fancy enough, different ways. But now, something that completely takes it from a different angle, which is that even if all the problems exist, it's the right type of food, etc., perhaps some involvement of a Jew, and we'll have to see again how central and how significant the involvement is, but perhaps that can mitigate against the problem. So, the basis of all the discussion in the Shulchan Aruch comes from a decent-sized, pretty big chunk of Gemara. What you have in front of you is actually a slightly abbreviated version, even. But let it not intimidate you. Let's learn it together, and then hopefully that'll put us in the right frame of mind to see some of the discussions by the poskim in the Shulchan Aruch. So Gemara begins as follows: Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Hiniach Yisrael Basar al Gabe Gacholim. Guy takes out a nice Jewish man takes out a steak. And he puts it on the fire. He puts it literally, on the coals. But for our purposes, it could be an oven, it could be a gas range, it could be a barbecue. He puts it where it's supposed to be to start getting cooked. But to be more specific, literal, it's kind of like the meat's on a spit, I think, when Chazals think of this or conceive of this, and there's, open flames underneath. Uba ovid kochaveim v'hipech bo. And you turn it over. You turn over the meat. So obviously that will help facilitate the cooking process. So now you have the question of, the Jew started cooking, but then came along the non-Jew and obviously contributed. What's the halacha? Nevertheless, despite the non-Jewish involvement, mutter. So the Gemara asks, second line, hey chidami, how could that be? I mean, you don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, but why should that be? So what's the case? E lema, if you'll tell me what the case was, to ilo hipech be hava bishel, that even with the non-Jew not having turned it over, it still would have cooked. Pshita, then it's obvious that it should be okay, because obviously then the non-Jew didn't really contribute anything. So then that's not such a shock that that should be permissible. Elalav, what rather must be the case, to ilo hipech, lo hava bashil. If the non-Jew would not have turned it over, it never would have gotten fully cooked. But if that's the case, going on to the third line now, amai mutar, then why should it be permissible? The only reason it got cooked was because of what the non-Jew did. After all, bishulei shel ovdei kochavim ninhu, isn't this bishulakum? So the Gemara answers as follows, middle of the third line. Lo, Tzricha, this is what was going on. If you had just left it the way it would have been, put it in the oven, turn it on 400, it would have taken 2 hours to cook. But because the non-Jew turned it over, it went quicker, it cooked in 1 hour. Mahu desema. What might you have said? Keruve bishula milsahi. You might have thought that the fact that the non-Jew, by his helping, made it cook faster, it only took an hour, when without his help it would have taken 2 hours. You might have thought that that is considered significant to the point of creating a prohibition. Kamash malan, no. That as long as if nothing would have done, if nature would have taken a course, it would have been cooked through the actions of the Jew. The fact that a non-Jew stepped in to expedite things does not hurt us from the halachic perspective. It is still considered kosher. Period. That's what the Gemara has as its first statement on the matter of a combined hybrid type case where the new Jew and the non-Jew were both involved. V'ha'amar Rav Asi, amar Rav Yochanan. The Gemara asks, but how can that be? The Gemara is just agitating. This is not willing to leave it alone. How could that be? The Gemara is not willing to accept. I'm at the end of the fourth line now. Kol shehu kamachal ben drushai. Didn't Rabbi Yochanan say that once a food is cooked to the amount that's referred to in the halacha as ma'achal ben drushai? Let's digress for a moment. Are you familiar with this phrase? And where it comes from? It's most famous. Its original application comes from Hilchos Shabbos. And this is the idiom that's used in halacha to refer to minimal edibility. In other words, how much do you have to cook something in order for you to have cooked it, you know, 100%? Then it's obviously cooked. The answer is no. It doesn't have to be cooked fully. The term that the Gemara uses in Shabbos, they explain, of all places, you never know, right? Perkei Avos says, Ezehu Chacham Halomed Mikol Adam. You can learn from everybody. Ben Drusai, they were a family of bandits. So since they were bandits, they were always on the run. So they would steal, and they'd, you know, run quickly, have to cook their dinner before the sheriff would find out and gallop over. And they'd quickly, so they learned how to cook very, very quickly. So that minimum amount is what we considered. If it was edible for the Drusais, it's minimally edible for us. Now how much is that? So that itself begs the question. This is a famous machlokes. The following two positions. Rashi and others say that it is 1/3. Which, when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, is a big chumrah. And if you cook it 1/3, then it's already cooked. Although, if you're talking about Ein Bishel Achar Bishel, then maybe it's a kula. But 1/3. The Rambam says it means 1/2. You have to cook it longer. So that would be conventionally referred to as a chumrah. You have to cook it longer to be considered cooked. The poskim say that since Bishul Akum is what kind of a halacha? Derabbanan, it's rabbinic. We have a right to be lenient. We assume that 1/3. Once something is cooked 1/3, we can call it cooked. So in this case, if a Jew would cook it 1/3, you get in the door, you're home free. That's the... But, again, back into the Gemara. So look at this. Rabbi Yasi, I'm Rabbi Yochanan. Kol shehu kamacha ben drusai. Once a Jew cooks it, and again, we'll substitute the word 1/3. A Jew's cooked it at least 1/3 of what it needs to be cooked. Ein bo mishum mishul avikachavim. Right, that's the halacha. That if you've cooked it minimally, so then the fact that a non-Jew comes and, you know, you're standing over the oven stirring the pot. It's an hour, it's going to have to be on the oven. So you're there for the first 20 minutes. And then he comes for the next 40 minutes, that's not a problem. Right? That's end quote. That's what Rabbi Yochanan had said. But the Gemara analyzes it and it says, well, what's the implication, of course? Ha! Eino kama'achal ben drusai, which would mean that if the Jew does not cook it even that much, he just cooks it for a minute or two. Yesh bo mishum bishuli avakachavim. That sounds like there should be a problem. And that seems to be, that implication, that conclusion that we're drawing, seems to run counter to the opening statement of the Gemara. Because the opening statement of the Gemara seemed to be that even if a Jew, the way the Gemara understands Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel in the beginning of the Gemara, even if the Jew only did a little bit, the Jew just put it on the oven. And if the Jew would have just done nothing and let it sit there, it would have cooked in 2 hours. The non-Jew came, turned it over, sped it up, it was in an hour. But the Jew barely did anything in the first part of the Gemara, and yet we said that's okay, as long as the Jew started it and it could have worked its way through. Yet here we're saying, no, it's not enough for the Jew to just do such an extremely minimal amount. The Jew has to at least cook 1/3. So at this point we have a contradiction in the Gemara. How are we going to resolve this apparent contradiction? So in the middle of the sixth line, after the exclamation point, the Gemara gives the following suggestion to differentiate between the cases. Hasam, in the case where we are machmir, kigon de osvei besilsa. What happened? The Jew cooked it a little bit, and then he took it off the fire and he put it in a basket. V'shakle ovkochavim, then the non-Jew took it, osvei betanur, he put it back on the oven to finish its cooking. In other words, what the Gemara is saying is that when the non-Jew came, he was doing a totally new act of cooking. So you'll say, was what this new act of cooking by the non-Jew, was that significant or not? So the answer is it depends. How much was it already cooked? If that's the question, then we have to say, well, if the Jew cooked it minimally one-third, then even though the non-Jew is doing a second new act of cooking, it's negligible, because fundamentally it's minimally edible. But if the non-Jew didn't eat, if the Jew didn't even do that much, he or she just did a barely a minute or two, and then it took it off the fire, and then the non-Jew comes in a separate act of cooking on his or her own, then that's going to prohibit it. That's the second case. But the first case in the Gemara, when we said that even if a Jew just cooks it a little bit, it's okay, that's because it never was off the fire. And since it was never off the fire, it doesn't matter who's standing in front of the, you know, barbecue, who's flipping the burgers, who's not, who's turning it over. Since it was always on the fire, we look at it as one long cooking process. And since the Jew started the process, it becomes permissible. That's what the Gemara says. So now the Gemara has now another question. I'm seven lines down, first words on the line. Yibayiluhu, the Gemara asks the question. Hiniach Ovid Kochavim. What if now we reverse the case? Not until now we were talking about the Jew was started cooking, the non-Jew came and replaced him. Now let's reverse that. The Jew is there, the non-Jew starts cooking, he leaves it there. The Hipech Yisrael, it's the Jew who turns over the meat. Mahu, what's the halacha? Amr of Nachman Bar Yitzchak. He says the following. Kal v'chomer. You know what a kal v'chomer is? Kal v'chomer is a classic halachic concept. I'll illustrate it with the same analogy that my Rebbe taught it to me the first time I came across it. If I were to say to you, David, you're so big and strong, you could lift 50 pounds. And then, sure enough, I did it. And someone asked, do you think he can lift 25 pounds? So you wouldn't need him to show you that he could. You'd be able to deduce it. If I could lift 50, of course I could lift 25. That is a kal v'chomer. There's a fancy Latin word for it also, but that's all you need to know. If you can lift 50, you can lift 25. So the Gemara now says, you asked, if the non-Jew starts and the Jew finishes, is that good or not? The Gemara answers, kal v'chomer, it's obvious that it is good. Why? Gomru bi'arov kochavim mutter. We just had a case before where we said a non-Jew does most of the work and finishes it up, and it's still okay. Gomru bi'ad Yisrael kol shekein, all the more so. Now, what it makes the application of kal v'chomer more complicated than my case of 50 and 25 is it's not always obvious that one case should be assigned the label of the 50-pound weight and the other case the 25-pound weight. What the Gemara is essentially doing is saying that it's a bigger chiddush to say that if the non-Jew finishes, it's still okay. You know, sometimes we have like a concept in halacha of nidon al shem sofo. You know, who's the one who gets credit for it? The guy who finishes the job. So if we're still willing to be lenient, when the non-Jew is the one who gets to say, ding, 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 burgers are ready, just because the Jew happens to have just first put them on the fire, and we're still willing to say, that's okay, that's like a 50-pound weight, that's a bigger chiddush. And if this kula, this leniency can lift up to such an extent, says the Gemara, of course, if it was reversed, if the non-Jew just put the burgers on the oven, but then it was the Jew who stayed there and finished it, all the more so we're going to say that is okay, and that is permissible. Itmar Nami, we have another similar halacha. Amar Rabba Bar Rav Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar Le Amar Rabbi Acha Bar Rabbi Yochanan. We're not sure who said it, but the bottom line is I'm now the last line and a half where I have it underlined. This is the salient principle that emerges from the Gemara. Bein sheiniach over kachavim hibech Yisrael. Whether it was a non-Jew who started and the Jew then flipped it over and finished the job. Bein sheiniach Yisrael v'hipech over kachavim. And whether it was a Jew who started and a non-Jew came and flipped it over and finished the job. Mutter. In both cases, we have right to be lenient. Ve'eino aser achit heitchiloso v'gumaro b'yad over kachavim. We're only going to prohibit it if it's started and finished, i.e. it's completely done by the non-Jew. But if a Jew participates in any meaningful way, that is sufficient, apparently, to label this act of cooking not Bishul Akum, our series title, but Bishul Yisrael, our sheer title. And that's, of course, what we want to get. We win the lottery, we get to eat the food. That is, again, the basic gist from the Gemara. Now, again, as we're always familiar with in halacha, as things develop and need to get more specific, they get more complicated. But that's the basic foundation that, as I say, tonight, and perhaps one or two more shurim as well, will all be built on, is this 1, 8, 9-line piece of Gemara. So far, so good? Any questions? Close. Yeah, we'll see. By the end of tonight, sure, you should understand that. Let's just see the Rambam and the way he paskins this halacha. The Rambam gives a specific example, but again, obviously, it's just meant to be illustrative. It's not supposed to be exclusive. Dagim ketanim, right? Our sardines or our small little fish, our herring, we keep on coming back to. Shemolchon Yisrael, akum. And somebody is the first person there, whether it's the Jew or the non-Jew, he salts them. Harihain kimoshin bashlu miksas bishul. Salting is, this is a principle we have in halacha in many areas, that salting, again, for certain foods, that's the way you prepare it. You make it from inedible to edible through salting it. And these fish are one of them. And whoever does that first act of salting, that person has already cooked it a little bit. So what happens afterwards? But it's still raw. It's just now ready to be put on the fire. After that, imtsalon akum acharkein. And then comes along another non-Jew, and he's the one who actually cooks it on the fire. Mutarin, it's permissible. Again, and this is specifically referring to the case where the Jew is the one who salted it. V'chol shebishul Yisrael ma'at bishulo. Because what's the principle? As long as the Jew is involved in some part of the cooking, bein betchila, bein besof, whether it was in the beginning of the process or the end of the process, mutar, it's permissible. Therefore, now he comes and paraphrases the case from the Gemara. If the non-Jew leaves some meat on the fire, or a pot on the burner, and he either he turns over the meat on the barbecue, or he comes along with his spoon and he stirs the pot, right, to make sure that the food doesn't settle, the food that everything gets stirred around to make and cook evenly. Or if the opposite occurred, either way, as long as the Jew was significantly involved, either he's the one who put it on the fire, he's the one who stirred. It doesn't matter. In either direction, it's permissible. Why? Because what did the last line of the Gemara say? The last line of the Gemara, it said, Eino aser ashtei tchilaso gmaro biyad ovukachavim. As long as the Jew does something significant, that is the basic principle which the Rambam is basically just reiterating.
Is this controversial? Because he's using an act that is not, and I mean, at first, share about,
yeah.
Salting fish was not one of those categories. So he's saying that you're doing that isn't cooking. It's a significant act of preparation, but it's not
right.
Cooking act.
It's a good observation, but you'll see by the time we finish this unit, it will not be controversial because we will see that things that are even pre the cooking process, like perhaps turning on a fire, are going to be significant enough.
The fire, right? Like,
but you're still not cooking anything. Right. Again, you could argue which one's better and which one's worse. But the point is that we have a very elastic definition here. That's correct. Now, one thing that's worth noting is that even though we're saying that it could be the beginning, the end, it does have to be something active. What do I mean? I mean is that one could have thought that perhaps something even more minimal would have been sufficient. Namely, we have a concept in other areas of halacha called Yisrael Omed Al Gabov, which would be called, let's say, the foreman. In other words, you're not the worker, but you're there standing, looking over their shoulder. Supervisor. Would that have been sufficient? Do we say that that's okay? After all, the Jew's right there the whole time. So look at the third source. That's the tshuva of the Rivash, Rav Yitzchak Bar Sheshes, one of the later Rishonim. He's asked a question about a particular food, which in the process of his analysis, he's answering, and he says, Kol shetiyeh ha-Yisraelis mikarefis habishul. As long as the Jew is doing something which contributes, and in this case particularly hastens the bishul, a kurva hanikera, something which, again, doesn't have to be large, but something that's quantifiable. Like the Gemara's example, right? It would have taken 2 hours, now it only takes one. So there's something that's contributed there. Or shetotziena mena tanur, what if the Jew takes it out of the oven? Fatachziwena Yisraelis teram yitbashel. Sorry, the non-Jew takes it out of the oven, and then the Jew, but it's not yet cooked, and the Jew puts it back in until it finishes and becomes fully cooked. To make it up to that one-third. Then it's okay. Any one of these variations. Middle of the second line. But other than that, ro'i le'esor. That anything less is simply not enough. Havle t'chilas of a gemara b'yad ain a Yehudi. Because as long as the one who's actually cooking is the non-Jew, that's a problem. And now I'm reading the underlined part. The ain amidas ha-Yehudis al-gaba. Don't think that if there's just non-Jew standing over and supervising, ma'ala umorida, it doesn't do anything. Klum, levatel tam chasnus. It doesn't help at all. The whole issue was that if they cook for you, you'll be appreciative. The fact that you're standing over them doesn't help. This is also a good term for you just to be familiar with. It's more meant to be taken as an idiom or figuratively. The term eino ma'ale ve'eino morid, right? It doesn't bring anything up, it doesn't bring anything down. So that is a little bit, doesn't work literally. The point of the phrase is that it doesn't make a difference. Standing over the cook is not going to help. A Jew has to participate, right? This could be good management 101, right? The boss has to roll up his sleeves sometimes and get involved. So this is an example halakhically of that. If you're just supervising, it's insufficient. But as long as you are involved at least, it's okay. Any questions so far? Okay, I have one question. Mashkiach, if just the mashkiach watching, that could help in terms of making sure the ingredients are kosher. But if the issue is, if the concern is that all the people who are doing the cooking are non-Jewish, so then the mashgiach just watching alone would be insufficient. Many, many times for caterers and for restaurants, the role of the mashgiach is also to be the one who turns on the oven, who puts the food in the oven, something like that. Exactly right. Because anything less than being active would be insufficient from the Bishul Akum perspective. So, stop for a second. So my next question was, what we're up to is, why should this help? At every stage along the way, when we talked about the food being Ola al Shacham Alachim, the Queen of England eating her sardines, and we always ask the question, why should this be a good? Okay, you know, again, we don't want to, you know, I'm never one to question a heter too many times, but we at least should understand where it's coming from. So the Rivash is at least the one who first plugs us in, just reminds us. You know, we might have forgotten, it's been so many weeks since we saw that Gemara. What's the primary reason quoted by authorities? We're worried, again, I think the Chazal would be acknowledged that it's not, in most cases, it's somewhat far-fetched. But that's the point. That's how careful we have to be, even when it's far-fetched. But we don't want it to be anything that is so intimate and so considerate on their part, as much as we appreciate it on some level. But if we're worried that it'll trigger enough casual appreciation that we could let our guard down and one thing could lead, unfortunately, to another. So, comes along, I'm not sure if there's anyone else who really mentions this in this context, but the Meiri. Meiri lived in Provence, that's southern France. The Meiri is quoted, I didn't have a chance to look it up in the original, although we actually have one here in the Beis Medrash, we could double check it, but in that Sefer, the Invaluable Sefer, we've quoted countless times in our Shirim, and we'll do it again tonight and next few weeks as well, the Chelkas Binyamin, the contemporary Sefer, so he quotes the Meiri, if you see here, Adach Lamed Ches Amid Aleph, quoting on our Gemara, Mashma Hatam, it sounds like, what does he say, the reason this whole Heter works, the Leka Lamecha Shlekirav Das, we don't have to be concerned that there'll be this closeness, Ela Aide Bishul Gamur, unless the non-Jew does the complete act of cooking. Now again, just to flesh it out, I guess what he's driving at is, again, a certain sense of appreciation. You know, if he does the cooking and says, okay, can you finish up? Well, that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking to put my feet up, watch the game, and for you to bring me the food. Not for me to have to cook half the meal. Again, I'm being intentionally flamboyant, so to speak, in my example. But the point is, the Meiri apparently was driving at is that their real appreciation is if they do something for you, right? You come over to their house and make you a meal. Okay. But you cooking with them, not that that would be, again, you could imagine a certain camaraderie in such a relationship too. But apparently, again, in the broad parameters and strokes the Chazal were concerning themselves with, they were willing to draw the line and say, you know what, if they do everything for you, then there's a more reasonable chance for concern. Whereas once Jews start getting involved in really being one of the workers, so to speak, so then they're co-workers. That's not the same thing, if you will. Again, I don't mean that they're actually employees, like we co-workers in someone's house. But they're co-workers in a sense, and in that sense, there's no reason to be overly appreciative, and therefore, can you imagine a situation where a Jew just turns on a light, on a fire, which we haven't even gotten to yet, by the way, that's not even going to get to tonight. But, and then it's still, he's appreciative, wow, you're the one who stood over the oven for 3 hours? Oh, yeah, the answer is Enechanami. And we'll see that perhaps certain poskim in certain versions of this issue are going to be saying, you know what, maybe it's not ideal to be so-so-makel. Because it's, again, we're really pushing the envelope with this kula. But again, somehow, it's not surprising that at least one Rishon, the Meiri, does this for us. We would have guessed it, and I'm glad the Meiri, at least we found one. Somehow this has to fit into the pattern, or else it would just be an arbitrary kula. So that's how the Meiri fits it in to the pattern. Question? Or did we help take care of that?
I
wouldn't say counterintuitive. I could just say that you could certainly. I mean, it's not counterintuitive.
You can see that, like, cooking together would be more of an intimacy.
But again, without again.
More intimacy than gratitude. I can appreciate the gratitude of you get a home meal.
Right, and that's what we're focusing on. Yeah. Okay. So now we've seen a few of the background sources. Let's see how when the bottom line push comes to shove. Cards on the table. How does the Shulchan Aruch paskin? Just what does the Shulchan Aruch say? Second to last source on your sheet. Underlined part. Kol shebishulo Yisrael ma'at. Bishulo, as long as the Jew does some of the cooking. Ben bechila, ben besof, in the beginning or the end. Mutter. Then he gives you the example. Etc. And the Jew turns it over, or he stirs with the spoon, etc. In all those cases, again, he's essentially paraphrasing the Rambam. Now, it's worth noting, I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves and make it too complicated for you, but when the Shulchan Aruch said, oh, it doesn't matter when the Jew participates, whether he's the first guy at the oven or the last guy, at the beginning, at the end, so at least for the Shulchan Aruch himself, Mr. Karo, it's not so simple, because we're going to see as we turn over the page that there is a discussion between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. Once the non-Jew has cooked it enough that it's already past the red line of 1/3, is it too late for the Jew to come in and help or not? So we'll see that the Ramah is lenient. The Ramah seems to say even until the last minute it's still not too late. It's like tshuva, it's never too late. But the Shulchan Aruch seems to draw a line in the sand and seems to say as long as the food is less than 1/3, then the Jew can help. And if it's a 4-hour thing, so you have a whole hour and 15 minutes. But once you get past that red line, then the non-Jew cooked it. It's too late. That's the point of no return. So we'll have to get back to this towards the end of the shiur to try to figure out the Shulchan Aruch. As Ashkenazim will be okay either way, hopefully because of the Ramah, but it's just worth noting that it's a little bit more complicated than we're presenting it now. So far, so good. Any questions?
But the non-Jew could do it at the end.
That's correct. You're noting a good inconsistency. We'll see. Good. I'm glad everyone's thinking. We all were inspired by Shavuos. So now, let's take each one of these cases one by one, because even though this was like the general statement of the Shulchan Aruch, now the Shulchan Aruch gets into nitty gritty. You'll see we just saw Sif Vav, right? That was what we just read. Kuf Yud Gimel Vav. I'm skipping Zion, and I'm going to Ches, and then we're also going to see Tes tonight. The reason is because Zion, which is very, very complicated and so, so important, that'll be next week's topics, Zion is where the Shulchan Aruch starts discussing how little can the Jew do. Not like he's in front of the oven actually cooking for an hour out of 4. You'll say it's only 1/4. But that's really cooking. No, I'm talking about, you know, just turning on the flame and stuff like that. And then it's that text which will then lead us into some of our modern day discussions with pilot lights and light bulbs and remote control things, but all that comes from things that we're not even going to see this week. That's why we're skipping Zion. But in Ches, the bottom of the page, the Shulchan Aruch says as follows: Nasan Yisrael Kedera al Ha'esh. So the Jew puts up the soup on the fire. Right? Just over Yontif, my mother was commenting that she doesn't like, you know, when people use that Yinglish. Did you put up the chulent? It's not an English phrase. But it's a Jewish phrase, because it comes from exactly, this is how we write in Shulchan Aruch. Nasan Yisrael Kedera al Ha'ish. You put it on the fire. So that's where it comes from, to put up the chulent or something to that effect. So just don't tell my mother.
You say that in English too, though. Put it on the fire.
Put it on the fire. You don't put it up. It's the up. It's the up. The up is the English, I believe. Nasan Yisrael Kedera al Ha'esh. So you put it up on the fire, and it's cooking somewhat. For whatever reason, Visilka, you take it off of the fire. Uba Ovid Kol Chavim. Ah, you're non-Jewish, Chveis, the housekeeper, says, oh, I thought she was just making the soup. Something must have happened. She turns on the fire back on, or she puts the thing from the trivet back onto the burner. Says the Shulchan Aruch, Usser! Where does this come from? Before we see the caveat, which will be very important in the next sentence, it comes from the Gemara itself. If you remember, the Gemara said, what if the Jew cooked it a little bit, then he took it out and put it in a basket, and then the non-Jew put it back? Then it's a separate act. If it wasn't really cooked at all by the Jew, and it's off the fire, and then it, so then, you know, it's like, that's a hard return on the computer. Right? It's a new sentence. It's got no connection to the one before it. Then we just looked, the non-Jew cooked it. Then you're in trouble. Okay, that's just so you know where we're coming from. Then the Shulchan Aruch continues, and he adds an important proviso. Ela im kein higia l'macha ben drusai. Shehu shlish bishulo kishasukah. He says, but there's one important caveat. It depends how far along in the cooking process it got before the Jew took it off the fire. If it made it the minimum one-third, the soup's going to have to be on the oven for an hour. And it was 22 minutes, and then you realize, oh no, I have to drive carpool. So you can't leave it, you know. Meanwhile, while you were gone, cleaning lady comes in. Oh, she must have forgotten. She puts it back on the fire. Clearly a new act, but it's going to be, I'm going to call the rabbi, what am I going to do? I tell my cleaning lady never to touch the oven, and look what she did. I'm having company for 10 tonight, and she put the chicken soup up on the fire. So the rabbi, well, let's see, how long does it usually take to cook? An hour? Well, how long had you cooked already? 22. You're in luck! Because as long as the Jew cooked it at least the one-third, then even though you wouldn't really serve it that way, but since if you were in absolute dire straits, you could eat it minimally, we view it as already cooked. You made it home. You're ready at the end of the race. Everything that else that happens is like halakhically static. It's irrelevant. And therefore, you're okay. When is there a problem? If you took it off the oven 15 minutes after you started. It's not even edible. Then, the fact of the matter is, you can't combine what you did and you started to what the non-Jew finishes, because you took it off the fire, so it's a Sof Pasuk, new Parsha, and then you'll have to be honest with ourselves. Who's the one who made it edible? The non-Jew? Then you couldn't eat it. It's an important halakha concept. As long as it stays on the oven, doesn't matter, and the non-Jew does nothing, that's, you know, just comes along at the end, that's fine. But if the non-Jew starts stirring it or whatever, it's still on the fire, also okay, because it never left the fire. But if it came off the fire, that's when we have a big period, and then we could be in trouble if it's the non-Jew who puts it back on. Okay, that's an issue when the Jew starts. You have to be very careful. There's a major distinction in halacha. If it stayed on the fire, we can look at it as one long process. And then as long as the Jew started even a little bit, we're okay. But if it came off the fire, we look at it as a new process, and then we have to evaluate it independently. Yeah. Let's say you're not sure.
And so you like it very rare, but if you were to like it well done...
It's still edible. I don't like meat rare at all, but I could eat it. You know, if I'm at a restaurant, if I have patience, I'll tell them to send it back. But if not, I'd probably eat it. Would I go back? I don't know, but I could eat it. Now, a question which is along the lines of what you're saying, which I was going to mention, I didn't put it on the sheet. Chachmas Adam, the great Chachmas Adam, we've seen him in previous weeks. So he discusses, what if you're not sure, right? Certain things are, you know, guesstimates, right? You know, how much salt you put in, abyssal, you know, so certain recipes, you know, you're not sure exactly. Or, if, for that matter, you're just not sure. You don't remember. You don't remember when you started. And if it's a matter of a few minutes, you can easily be unsure. So says the Chachmas Adam, in case of doubt, again, honest doubt, not a joke, an honest doubt, you have a right to be makel. So that might, if the issue is, how do you evaluate one-third? If it's plausible, you can be makel. That's the Chachmas Adam. Okay, now, you picked up a few minutes ago on the potential inconsistency. That's right here. Well, whether we should be consistent or not. Now, let's put it this way. Let's put on our thinking caps. Before we see any sources, let's think. If we're going to be consistent, which, until we know otherwise, that's what rational people do. They remain consistent. So right now, what did we just establish? The principle that in this case, when the Jew started, once it hits one-third, Luckily for us, you're at the point of no return. It doesn't matter if you took it off the fire 100 times. It's still okay because you cooked it 1/3. Now, if we were to reverse the roles, and the non-Jew started, and then the Jew came to finish up, and we wanted to apply this 1/3 rule, if we want to be consistent, what conclusion should we reach?
The Jew has to be involved before it's 1/3 cooked.
Yes, but let's just say it straight. If the non-Jew cooks it at least 1/3, then it doesn't matter how much time the Jew helps afterwards, it's too late. That's what we would have guessed, right? That would be consistent. Okay, look at the top of your sheet. The tour, right? We know the tour is the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch. One of the differences, it's not just that he lived first, one of the differences is that I'm guessing, by way of analogy, this is probably true in other cultures as well, it's really true in Halacha, very understandably, as the legal codes have evolved over the generations, so they've gotten more and more streamlined. So the tour, at least if you talk about the tour of the Shulchan Aruch progression, let's put it that way. The tour quoted a variety of sources. He's usually gives you a definitive conclusion, but very often he'll quote you multiple opinions, right? Which is, and he tells you the name, and he gives you some of the literature. By the time you get to the Shulchan Aruch, every now and then you'll see that, but it's much more common for him just to tell you, boom, this is what I think. Or there are two opinions, but not to get into the details. The tour is more commonly going to be a fuller treatment of things. So here he quotes a machlokas. And it's important always to know, not surprisingly, not only is it an Ashkenaz-Sfard divide, the Rashba and the Rush, but more than that, the tour was what relationship to the Rush? His son. Right, so he usually follows his father. So what's the machlokas? Kosav HaRashba. You just got through telling me that if the Jew cooks it for 1/3, that he's in the clear, even if he took it off the fire and then the non-Jew finished it. Hu Hadin? So then the same thing should be true, i.e., will be consistent in applying this rule. In Bishlu Ovid Kochav and Kamacha Ben Jusai. If the non-Jew is the one who cooked it 1/3, Ein Lo Heter HaKakach Ayidei Gemar Bishlu Yisrael. And then it got taken off the fire. There's nothing you can do. It's too late. The non-Jew cooked it. It's edible. It's too late. Then we view that. We give it a stamp. Bishul Lakum. There's nothing you can do about it. Very consistent. V'lo Nehira La'adoni Ovi HaRush. My father, my master, the Rush, disagreed. De La'hokel Hichshivu Kamachal Ben Jusai Kimavushel. We're only using the 1/3 rule when it helps us. He's honest about it. We're going to pick and choose. Next time you hear a rabbi say you can't pick and choose, you'll quote your Ardeya Simon Kuf Yud Gimel. Okay. A lot of nachas from that kid, I'm sure his parents are going to have. Your Ardeya Kuf Yud Gimel, the Rosh says we can pick and choose. When it helps us, we're going to go with the 1/3. But in this case, if it's going to hurt us to be machmir, we don't do it. Hilchach afilu and bishlu kamacha ben Josiah by Yisrael v'chidabo v'gamro mutar. As long as the Jew gets in the game, says the Rosh, it's okay, even if it's after 1/3. Wow. So how do we paskin in this explosive machlokas? There's a machlokas about that. I think everyone in the room is Ashkenazic. It's your lucky day. The Shulchan Aruch says, in Bishlo Ovid Kochavim, Kamacha Ben Jusai, the Gomro Yisrael, Yesh Lesor. Once you hit 1/3 by the non-Jew, it's too late. So even the Shulchan Aruch, even for the Sfaradim, he has a few kulos. He says, El Imkem Ye Erev Shabbos. Friday, you come to the rabbi, oh my gosh, there goes the soup, there goes the chulent. So Erev Shabbos, we're going to be makel for you. Oh, Erev Yontif. Osh Yesh Hesed Merubah, it's a very great amount of money, you can't afford to throw this out. But unless there's incredibly extenuating circumstances, the Shulchan Aruch says we have to be consistent, like the Rashba. Consistency requires us to be machmir here. Comes along the Ramah. The Yesh Matirin Bechol Inyan, that's the tour and the rush, that we're lenient, we pick and choose. V'chein Noagin says the Ramah, the Ashkenazic practice is to be lenient. Now, the next source, I'll paraphrase it for you. This is our friend again, the Chelkas Binyamin, So he quotes what I alluded to before. If you remember, when I said before, right, the Shulchan Aruch on the first page had said, as long as a Jew helps, even in the end, it's okay. Now you have the Shulchan Aruch himself, the Mechaber, saying, no, once it's one-third, it's too late. Right, turn over your page for a second. When we saw the Shulchan Aruch say, second to last source on the page, Kol Shabishol Yisrael Ma'at, as long as the Jew did a little bit, Ben B'tchila Ben B'sof, whether it's in the beginning or the end. So he'll ask a question. Now the Shulchan Aruch says, what do you mean? The Jew does a little bit at the end? That doesn't help, because it was already one-third by the non-Jew. Oh, so within two paragraphs, you seem to have a contradiction between the Shulchan Aruch, an internal contradiction. So some Mefarshim say, and this is very, very dochuk in the Lashon, though, when he said basof, he meant basof of the first stage of the race, because the rest of the race is irrelevant. Basof of the relevant time, i.e. within the first third. So if it's a 20-minute third, even if you came in as the Jew at minute 19, you were okay. But once you're out of 20 minutes, you're done. It's a very forced reading. But that's what a number of Achronim say to explain it. The Pre-Chadash, this is again, I'm paraphrasing what's in this Chagos Binyamin here, the Pre-Chadash has a different Taich. One I prefer, again, I don't know if this is the consensus or not, but I think it's a better reading, personally, I think. Right now I'm convinced of it. Not just because it would be a little more lenient, but I just think it makes more sense to be consistent with what we had said in the Shulchan Aruch. Because what did we just say in the case of the Jew? One of the key factors was what? Whether you have a period, i.e. was it taken off the fire or not. In this test, which you just read, Shulchan Aruch doesn't say anything about that or not. Says the Pre-Chadash, that's what you have to read in. This Chumrah of the Shulchan Aruch was only speaking about if you took it off the fire. So then, that's exactly parallel and consistent with the previous paragraph when it came to a Jew. If you take it off the fire, it depends if it's first third or after the first third. But let's say it stayed on the fire the whole time. Then the Pre-Chadash suggests that even the Shulchan Aruch agrees, Bein B'tchila, Bein B'sof, as long as the Jew participated a little bit, even at the end, it should be good. I like that, because it makes the two paragraphs in a row, Ches and Tes of the Shulchan Aruch, consistent, which is that it has to do with taking off the fire. Whereas if according to the first, the simple way of reading Tes, he doesn't mention it. But, again, since we saw in the earlier sources that they were looking at these as two sides of the same coin, I would prefer to assume that that was the critical factor in both. And that's exactly what the Pre-Chadash suggests. Another caveat which is important, which is in the next phrase of the Chalkas Binyamin, in the next paragraph, the fourth one on your sheet, he just points out, before you get all giddy about your heter, he does point out the following, that if the non-Jew started off with the one-third, so he's in a very strong position, right? If we want to be Mekel, it's not enough for the Jew to just come in, mish around a little bit, and then walk away. He has to be Gumru, but you got to finish it. And as long as you finish it, you know, if you follow baseball at all, there's a category called the save. And it can sometimes be a very unfair category because you could come in and get one out, throw one pitch, and you could get the save if you end the game. So that's what the Chagos Binyamin says. You got to end the game. You got to finish it. If you finish it, then it'll be okay. Now, as I say, whatever we just said, this whole razzle-dazzle about the Pre-Chadash, if you followed it, great. If not, it's okay, unless you're Sephardic. As an Ashkenaz family, it's okay. We're lenient. As long as the Jew participates in some part of it, it is okay. Again, and he finishes it at the end. If he starts, then he's okay. If the Jew, non-Jew starts and gets to one-third, then the Jew has to finish. Okay? Now, let's just see two little things, and then we'll be done, including how does this show itself very practically. Let's bring this together as something that you can walk away with, you can understand. Look at the English source. Many hashkachos that follow the minhag of the Ramah permit, you should just know, I'm not comfortable with some of his language, but I'm just quoting here, okay? The Goyisha companies to produce products that require further processing by the consumer. Since the food cannot be eaten without additional cooking, further processing by the Yid renders the food Bishul Yisrael. Some examples of such foods are pasta and frozen french fries. Pasta is fully cooked. Then whatever the process is, they do to dry it. So you'll ask, how is that okay? So unless you want to tell me that maybe Mashkiach goes to the company and, you know, he's in Italy where they're making them and they're rolling the pasta and he's turning on the vat every time, that'd be very, very involved. More likely is that when the OU, again, I don't know if there's the OU per se, but I think it is, and others probably as well, they give Ashkacha even though it's fully cooked by a non-Jew. Aye, Bishalakum. But it doesn't matter because before you can eat it, you got to cook it. That is at least Bishul Ma'at. It's more than that, really. You are the one who's cooking it now. And therefore, that defines it as Bishul Yisrael, not Bishul Akum. And that's why it becomes permissible. Okay? That's a practical example of just this point that we had just seen. As opposed to if you understood the simple understanding of the Shulchan Aruch, the Machaber, you'd have a problem. But if you hold like the Rama, as long as a Jew does part of the cooking process, he's okay. Okay? Now, what you may be thinking, got to know each other a little bit. Mm-hmm. You ask questions, so now I'm getting to know your pattern of thought. You may be anticipating the next final source. If you are, that's good. If not, don't worry about it. The Shulchan Aruch is written by Rav Yosef Karo. He is most well known, of course, for that, or the Beis Yosef, but he also wrote Tshuvos under the title Avkas Rochel. Okay, that's just a trivia tidbit for you. In the last Hebrew source here, the Darche Tshuva, Armun Kacher Dayin, he quotes Divrei Maran HaBeis Yosef Peshut Avkas Rochel, the following case, without getting into the exact details, it's very similar, frankly, to a pasta or something like that, where the non-Jew cooked, this is a wheat product, but he cooked it totally, then they dry it to the point that it becomes inedible. And it can only then be edible when it's cooked a second time. So the question was asked to him, if the first cooking was done completely by a non-Jew, but then they added a treatment to it to make it inedible, when the Jew then comes and does the second cooking, even though it had already been cooked once before completely, not just a little bit, not just one-third, 100% it was cooked. Then they dried it, and now I'm going to cook it again, which is sounds very similar to the spaghetti if you assume that it's inedible when it's dry. Now, if you assume that certain girls in dormitories, I'm told, eat dry pasta or something like this. I don't think guys ever did that, but they say that certain girls do these things.
Girls eat raw cake mix.
All sorts of weird things. Right, right, right. Girls are weird. We know that. Do they do that? Anyway, so, but perhaps they don't count. So, then spaghetti would be an example of this. So, is that permissible or not? Not one-third. The non-Jew cooked it 100%. Then it became inedible, and now the Jew has to cook it a second time to make it edible. So the Avkas Rochel was asked about that question. Again, the previous cases with the Ramo were not when it became inedible, it wasn't finished.
Oh, okay.
Here's where it was a question of one-third, and it wasn't finished, and the Jew came in at the end and finished it up. Here's it was done 100%. I mean, you're dead in the water. But instead of just serving it then, they want to package it and ship it off to America. So they make it inedible, they freeze-dry it, or whatever they do to it, in a particular case. And then you got to cook it in your oven, you know, and Uncle Ben's rice or whatever, you got to cook it. So says the last underlined part in the Hebrew, Kaven de Isser de Rabbananhu, Yeshismach lahakel. We can be lenient. And he says, since it can't be eaten until it was cooked a second time, Alidi habishol mechadash, v'habishol ha'echad einu nikar behen. The fact that it was once cooked in the plant, who knows where, is essentially forgotten fact. Why are you eating it? Well, who made it edible? If you ask anybody. Me, I put it on the stove. Therefore, he's lenient. And this is a tshuva that most poskim rely on, and we'll conclude with one final practical ramification of this, and that's, again, the last English source. Many kashrus organizations have relied heavily upon this opinion that when certifying instant powdered potatoes, potato flakes, and the Heilige Pringles. Now, I digressed where I have those three dots. He gives you a whole little three-paragraph thing about how those are made respectively, and how basically first they cook the potatoes, so now they're edible. And if it was cooked by an Andrew, you should say a problem. But then, whether it's in whichever respective thing, for example, Pringles, unlike regular potato chips, which are just sliced, fried, and put in the bag, they are ground up into some paste, and then they're cooked again. So the question was, how can you allow this to happen? So the answer, the heter was, apparently, as long as the second cooking, you have that paste. So if the mashgiach then turns on the oven, that'll be okay. The fact that he wasn't who knows where when they were boiling up the potatoes doesn't matter. Or the mashed potatoes, when you do it. Right, they cook the potatoes, then they grind them up, they make them into a powder, and you bring them home and you have to cook them. All of that is permissible if you rely on this theory, that if it becomes inedible, it's okay. Now, he pointed out that it's not so clear anymore because the companies are using different emulsifiers due to government regulations. Once this changes, the instant potatoes were able to be reconstituted and made edible merely by the addition of cold water. This being the case, the heter of the Avkas Rochel is no longer applicable and may not be relied upon. Presently, some kosher organizations primarily rely upon the fact that potatoes are no longer actually cooked in water, cooked by using steam, which if you remember from weeks and weeks ago, we saw was perhaps room to be lenient. Perhaps steaming itself does not constitute cooking. But that's, again, something that we'll let the kosher organizations like the Star K and the OU worry about. But just to give you, as an example, where this could come in, and perhaps the answer, again, the only reason I'm assuming that they're not giving pasta as an example is because I think it's edible. Yeah, because if you assume it's inedible, then why is that any different than the Pringles? They cooked it, then they made it inedible, and now I'm going to cook it again.
Yeah, it's different because they made pasta. When they cook the potatoes, they make them into potatoes, and then like the form changes.
But fresh pasta is edible.
No, but it's still pasta. Like, you have an idea of pasta
so what?
Fry.
So what?
Yeah, but
you made a potato, then you made it inedible, and now I have to cook it a second time. That's his case.
So aren't they making it into an ingredient again?
That doesn't have to be. I don't know if that matters. Maybe you're right. Because again, it seems to be obvious he seems to be going out of his way not to, he mentioned pasta in the first one, not in the second one. So I would have thought that pasta would apply to the second one. But apparently not, so we don't have to worry. But I'm just saying, let's leave it then to the mashed potatoes. So you have the mashed potatoes and the Pringles. That's one example where this played out. And then in the earlier case, you had the pasta or the frozen french fries. Okay?
When he says the frozen french fries,